So what we're coming to now is the key result for this lecture, and it indicates how we can have confidence that our observed results have some relation to actual system results. Okay. And so in general, the type of, when I say results or parameters for the system, what I'm referring to is mean and variance for various quantities, or perhaps again binning them up into percentiles instead. Now, we have seen, at least in what we've seen, sort of roughly how you can extract this data for a single trace or single output of a simulation. And what we're going to observe is that this is not sufficient. What we get from a single observation is essentially a single observation of a random variable. And single observations of random variables don't tell us a whole lot about distributions in general. Okay. So what we're going to need to do is take many observations, more than one observation, of the same quantity. Okay. And by examining this range of observations, we should be able to say something about how this range, in particular in terms of an average, how this range relates to the overall system average. Okay. So, throughout we're going to refer to our system parameter as theta, and then theta hat will be the estimate of this parameter. Okay. We're going to produce theta hat by taking a number of samples of the system parameter. So again, if it's the average waiting time, we'll run our simulation a number of times, calculate the average waiting time each time. These are random variables then. And by examining all of these sample points, so more than one sample point, and essentially taking the average of all these sample points, we're going to hope to come up with an estimator that's somewhat close to the actual system parameter. Okay. And so intuitively that sounds like a reasonable thing to do. What we would like to do is sort of quantify what does somewhat close mean. So we've got our estimator that we think is okay. But how close is it to the actual system parameter? And to do this, what we're going to do is derive a measure called a confidence interval. And the confidence interval gives you an interval around our estimator in which our, so around theta hat, in which our actual parameter theta is likely to fall. Okay. And what we'd hope is if we could get that interval to be fairly narrow, then we'd say, we've got a good estimator of our system parameter. Okay. So, what follows is a derivation of this confidence interval. So how can we match up our estimators with actual values? Okay. So, in general, what we're going to be concerned with is determining means or averages, and also variances, because the variance gives us sort of information as to sort of how much you're going to bounce around the mean. Okay. So, we start out with a set of n, again, independent, identically distributed random variables. We assume that the distribution they have is related to, again, the system this information that we want. So they have a mean of mu and a variance of sigma squared, where those would be the system means and say system variances. Okay. So, if we want to estimate the system mean and the system variance, we do this in sort of the simplest way possible by averaging. To get the mean, we just average our observations. To get the variance, well, we'll start by sort of averaging the variance, so averaging the variability around the mean. We're going to actually jump to a slightly different figure, so the difference is whether the divisor is 1 over n or 1 over n minus 1. And we'll discuss why in a minute. Okay. So, we have a number of observations, and again, from these observations, we want to see what we can say about the overall behavior of the system. Now, our estimators, our two estimators, our estimator for the average and our estimator for the variance. Our first estimator for the variance are what are called the sample averages, obviously because you're averaging over the sample values. We say that the sample average is an unbiased estimate of the system average in the sense that if you take again if you take the expectation of this sample average, you get mu. S squared is biased in the sense that if you take the expectation of S squared, you don't get sigma squared. If you take the expectation of sigma squared, you do get the second value for S squared, you do get sigma squared out. Okay, so what we'd like to think is that if you have an unbiased estimator, it's a pretty good estimator for a system parameter. Again, the only assurance that we have is if you take averages, then the averages give you the same value. Okay. So this measure of bias is just, again, how close the expectation or the expectation of your sample values comes to the actual parameter. Okay. And so we said that should be X bar is unbiased. So what that means is that the expectation of X bar should be equal to mu. And we can just calculate that out directly. And we see that the expectation of, we just plug in our value for X bar, which is 1 over n, the sum of Xi's. Since this is, what? I hate. Sorry about this. We'll just get rid of that, I guess. Okay, we'll just get rid of that. Okay, so, where was I? Since this is a finite sum, we can move the expectation in. And we've said that our x's are IID distributed with a mean of mu. So the expectation of any individual xi is mu. So we get the sum n times of a constant, so that's n mu, divide by the n, and we get our mu out. So just that's a straightforward calculation. Okay. So if we try to do the same thing to our sample average estimator of sigma squared, we don't get sigma squared out. Again, we can just replug in our value for S squared. And remember that our variances are, again, variances from the mean. So what we do first is we express everything in terms of the distance from the mean. And you can see what happened here is we just subtracted off mu there and added on a mu there. Okay. We can then, we've got the square of this term, so we just multiply it out. And then we can examine sort of each of these terms in turn. So we have the expected value of 1 over n, I equals 1 to n, xi minus u squared. Okay, and we'll keep that one. And so that's just our variance. Okay. And then we have our second term. If we take the expectations, first you have to take the sum, and if you take the sum here, you'll get an x bar term, and so you have minus 2, the expectation of x bar minus mu squared, and the third term, again, is the expectation of x bar minus mu squared, so you can then combine these two terms, and you get a single expectation of x bar minus mu squared. Okay. So this term, 1 over n, my 1 over n sum I equals 1 to n xi minus mu squared, well, that's your variance, okay? And, yeah, you see that by pulling the expectation in again, you get the 1 over n summation I equals 1 to n expectation of xi minus mu squared. Expectation of xi minus mu squared is your variance sigma squared. So you have n sigma squared and divide out the n. And then you have this second term, which we don't actually know what it is, but we know that it's going to be non-zero. Okay. So what we have is that our estimator actually gives you a slightly smaller value for variance, or maybe a lot smaller value for variance than your original value. Okay. So our second estimator, where we use 1 over n minus 1 times the quantity instead of 1 over n minus n, turns out to be an unbiased estimator, and so this is why it's usually the one chosen as the estimator in your statistics books, and this is the one that Peros will use and the one that Banks uses as well. Okay, so again, you plug in your term, and then you you multiply out your square, so you get xi squared minus 2 xix minus xi x bar plus x bar squared. And again, what you want to do is treat each of these terms individually. Okay, so we have three terms. We have n, expected value of xi squared, which is related to the variance. Again, if you had normalized according to the average, that would give you the variance. And you have 2, the expectation of x bar over some xi squared. And finally, you have the value expectation of x bar squared, and the sum gives you, that summing over n ends up giving you n of those. Okay, so just breaking that out, we can observe that our sum of I equals 1 to n xi is actually n times x bar. Okay, that's just by the definition of x bar. Okay, and so again, once you do that, you get, you can combine these two terms and you get n expectation of xi squared minus n expectation of x bar squared. Okay. So, expectation of xi squared is related to the variance. It's sigma squared plus mu squared. So we can replace the expectation of xi squared by sigma squared plus mu squared. And similarly, we can try and replace the expectation of x bar squared by sigma bar squared, mu bar squared. The issue here is that we might not know what the values for sigma bar and mu bar are. Okay. But we use one final trick with the central limit theorem. We've mentioned this earlier, that if you sum enough IID random variables together, then their distribution begins to look normal with a variance of mu, with an mean of mu and a variance of sigma squared over n. Okay, so we can plug these values. So sigma bar squared is sigma squared over n, and mu bar squared is just mu squared. And if you plug in those values, you know, you can tidy it all up, and you see you do get sigma squared out. Okay. So these estimators are what we are going to have to work with in our system. Yes?
The last line should be the expectation of x squared must be n multiplied by sigma squared. The last line. Sigma squared should be multiplied by n.
There is a typo in this. I will post the correction. obviously when I went from here, I was supposed to remove the ends from this side. Okay. So I divided out by n, but I forgot to remove the ends there. So yeah, I'll post a correction to that. Okay. So these are the estimators that we're going to use, and what's the main question is how close is this estimator in particular, how close is the mean to the actual system mean? Okay. And so we're going to we're going to try and estimate this using what's called a confidence interval. And again, a confidence interval is an interval around our estimator into which our actual parameter is likely to fall. Now, what we have to do is pin down what do we mean by likely. And in this case, what likely means is we pick a percentage of the time that the estimator falls into this interval. And then once we pick that percentage of time, we can calculate what this interval is. Obviously, the bigger your percentage of time, the wider your interval is going to get. Okay. So there's a trade-off between how confident you can be of being in the interval and what size this interval is. So what we would hope is that, in general, our interval is relatively small, meaning that if we have our estimator, then our estimator is pretty close to the actual system parameter. And typically, you look at confidence levels somewhere in the 90% range. Okay. The confidence interval is going to be calculated using the central, or by appealing to the central limit theorem. Again, if we can make things look like a normal distribution, then this idea of ranges is fairly well studied for normal distributions. You've probably heard reference to the bell curve for student performance. So the assumption is that if you've got a big class, then you're going to have this curve, which looks, you know, just like a hill, and you would expect that the results that students get to be centered around some average and then fall sort of uniformly, fall on either side of this curve according to, again, this normal distribution. Okay. And so, as I said before, in general, it's not, for the normal distribution, it's not possible to directly calculate out these ranges, but there's tables produced that allow you to calculate the ranges. Okay, so we have a slight variation on the central limit theorem I quoted before, just in the sense that I've divided out by n this time. In the last one, we left the n out. Okay, so we have this estimator x bar, and in this case, we let x bar be a function of how many observations we have, and so x bar sub n is 1 over n summation I equals 1 to n of xi. So it's the average of n of these observations. What we say is that as n gets large, our distribution approaches normal with mean mu and variance sigma squared over n. Okay. So there's two things that are good about that. We have our average in the right place, and our variance is decreasing. So as n gets big, the variance is shrinking. Okay, so that means you're getting closer and closer to this actual, your distribution is falling more and more tightly around the mean. Okay, so again, just to look at this graphically, we see this is, we start in this case with our uniform random variables, and we look at summing up 2 to the k of them. So we start 1, 2, 4, 8, 16, and 32. Okay, and what we see is that obviously with 1 you have your original distribution, and as you go on towards higher numbers, the distribution begins to look more and more like this L curve, and we see that again it's centering around the mean we want, and it's also, the variance is decreasing in the sense that it's coming closer and closer into this mean. Okay. So, this is good for us in the sense that it's well understood what percentage of a population falls within various intervals around a mean for the normal distribution. Okay. And usually, the distributions are expressed as multiples of the variance, and you say you can calculate what percentage of your samples fall within specific multiples of the variance. Okay, so we can see in this case, I should say standard deviation, not the variance. The standard deviation is sigma, not sigma squared. So in this case, we can see 68%, well, I shouldn't say in this case, always 68% of your samples will fall within one standard deviation of the mean. Okay. So we're, and again, the standard deviation is frequently how student performance results, etc., are categorized. You're told you fall within a certain number of standard deviations of the mean. So, within one standard deviation, your average. Within 2 on the top side, you'd be considered pretty good. 3, you're considered great, etc. Okay, we're looking at, we need to answer a slightly different question, which is, we have a percentage in mind. For instance, we want 95% of our samples to fall in the interval. And exactly what is the interval? So, again, it's all done through tables. Okay. So, we're going to pick a percentage, which is called our confidence level, and then find the interval around the mean so that that percentage of the samples fall in that interval. Okay. And so again, this interval is going to be expressed as some multiple of the standard deviation. It's just not going to be a integer multiple anymore. Okay, so just to make this a little more concrete, in general, again, you can Google it or whatever, you can find any number of tables that relate the percentage of the population that falls one side or other of the mean to how many standard deviations away from the mean your interval is. And so in this case, we've chosen our confidence level to be 95%. The table is of the form that you're looking at one half of this graph. So you're looking at what happens between the mean and some positive interval beyond the mean. Okay, and so if you want to get sort of either side of the mean, you've got to double your values. In this case, so 95% is 0.95, half of 0.95 is 0.475, and so we can read off what multiple of the standard deviation we need. In this case, we need 1.9, and then going up the table, 6. So it's 1.96 times the standard deviation will encompass 95% of our samples. Okay. So, this is essentially what we need. We've massaged our problems so that we've generated something that's normal in distribution and for which we want to know what this mean is. And then we can given the mean and an estimate of our variance, we can calculate this confidence interval. Okay. So we don't know mu and sigma. We'd like to estimate them. We're using our unbiased estimators for mu and sigma. So our estimator for mu is just the sample average. And if n is large enough, 30 is usually considered to be large enough, then x bar is going to have a normal distribution. Okay. And furthermore, the mean is going to be, so the mean of x bar is going to be mu. And what we'd like to say is that if we actually take values of x bar, so if we have our sample runs and we actually get values for x bar, then most of the time those values are going to be close to mu. Okay, so now in order to compute our confidence interval, we said that the confidence interval was in terms of the standard deviation, which is part and parcel of the variance. And in this case, we don't know it, but we'll use our unbiased estimator to approximate it. Okay. And what we get out at the bottom here is just a slightly simpler to compute version of the unbiased estimator. I threw in the derivation just because Paris didn't, and it's not terribly hard, but I'll let you read through it yourself. It's not something that's sort of rocket science and that we should worry about too much. Again, if you need to compute the estimator of the variance, then this formula is a little easier to use. Okay, and so what we do is we express our confidence interval not in terms of the actual variance, but rather in terms of our estimate in the variance. Okay. So you're adding some degree of imprecision to your calculation, but that's just something that's understood, and it's generally thought to be within tolerable levels. Okay. So, again, to wrap up, what we've done now is we have produced an estimate of our system average, so that's our system parameter, and an interval around that estimate in which our actual system parameter is likely to fall. And again, since S should be decreasing with N, and we've got an additional factor of N here, the bigger sample N we can take, then the more likely we should be to actually get quite close to our parameter. Now, there's always going to be a certain probability that that your estimate falls outside of the parameters. So again, you're just getting, it is just that, an estimate. Okay. So this is sort of, again, the key result. This is how people categorize how good their output is by calculating this confidence interval. Okay. Now, there's a number of issues with calculating this confidence interval. Again, we've made a number of approximations. We assumed N was large enough to account to make the distribution look normal. We have inserted in an estimate for our standard deviation, since we don't know the actual standard deviation. And we've also made this assumption that our observations, so our sample points, the XIs, were independent of each other, so uncorrelated, so knowing one wouldn't help you with any of the any other one. So what follows is a discussion of sort of how you can deal with how various of these assumptions impact on the system and how you can deal with them. Okay, so our first assumption was that we had a large sample size, sort of greater than 30, and excuse me, also that our estimate of the variance was good enough. Okay. Now, if either of those assumptions is not correct, then there, and in particular, if you have a fairly small sample size, then we can use the same procedure, but with a slightly different distribution. Okay. The student's T distribution is another way, in another distribution that represents sums of random variables. In this case, it's the sum of a small number of random variables. Okay. Now, the actual values for the student's T distribution are dependent on the number of samples excuse me, you take. Okay. And so and also on what's called the degrees of freedom. The degrees of freedom is how many parameters are you estimating in your calculation. So here we're estimating the variance, so we have, so we take away 1 degree of freedom for that. Okay. So we end up with, we take a number of samples and we subtract off 1 degree of freedom, and we can calculate the confidence interval then in the same way we would for the normal, except obviously a different, slightly different distribution, in the sense that we could pick our probability, and then we can define the confidence interval in terms of a multiple away from a multiple of our standard deviation away from the mean. Okay. So what do we see about this distribution? Well, it can be shown that as the distribution approaches as the number of degrees of freedom gets larger, the distribution approaches the normal distribution. Here we'd see that we can look at our point 0.025. So again, that's half of our 5% in the tail, and we can see that again we have the same distance and the same multiplier as we had before of roughly 1.96. Okay. If we have a smaller number of samples, so in the example we use 11 samples, well, then our degrees of freedom is 10. Then for that same value, we get the wrong thing. We should get 2.23 as our multiplier. So X bar should be the interval should be plus or minus 2.23 away from the mean. And the main thing to notice about that is it's a slightly bigger interval than we would have had before, representing the greater degree of uncertainty we have about our system. Okay. So, we have assumed so far that our sample data, our XIs, are independent of each other. And so it's important to note that you have to be careful then about how you collect your data, that it is indeed independent. Okay. So if we look at an example, for instance, of waiting times, and if we look at a single simulation run, if we just took samples of the waiting times sort of near to each other, then these values actually wouldn't be independent. Intuitively, you can think that sort of the waiting time for one variable, or for one arrival, and the one that arrives after it should be in some ways similar, because the waiting time will indicate if there's a big queue or if there's a small queue, etc. So if you know that one arrival waited a long time, the likelihood is the next arrival also will wait a long time. So they're not independent samples. Okay. So you can't just take samples out of a single run of the simulation and expect to get sort of statistically significant results. So what we need to do is have a way of producing independent samples, and we're going to look at two ways, batch means and replications. Paris mentions a third, which is the regenerative method, but this is it's a sort of a fairly restrictive, it will work in certain circumstances, but you put some restrictive assumptions on it, so you can read about it, but we'll just sort of go for the more mainstream methods. Okay, so probably the most clear-cut is replications. Instead of producing one run of your one simulation run, you produce 30 simulation runs, or some number greater than one simulation runs. This gives you an indication of why you might not always have enough samples to approximate the normal distribution, why you might want to use the teachers instead. Each of those runs obviously is going to cost time to produce. Okay. A second technique is essentially to run your simulation for a really long time and to take each and then to split it up into segments. That's the batch technique or batch method. Oh, now what happened to my slide? God's sakes, what happened there? Okay, something got put in the wrong order. So, again, for this batch method, you have a long run, and then you split the run up into chunks. Okay. And, again, it's likely that around the edge of the chunks, there's going to be some... So that those results are not going to be independent. But if you take, if you go sort of sufficiently far away, there is independence. So again, if you make your batch size big enough that this sort of region of independence is fairly small, then overall your system, overall your observations of the system are going to be independent. So what we do, again, is we take sort of big batch sizes, we take the average for each, we average each of these observations, and so while individual observations in there are not independent, they're related to each other, the averages you would get for each of these are reasonably independent. Okay. So our samples now are the batch averages. And our overall system estimator is the average of the batch averages. And our overall estimator of variance, again, is the unbiased estimation of the variance of the batch averages. Okay, so we've got sort of one more layer of averaging in there, but it ensures our independence. Okay. And again, replication's probably conceptually a little more straightforward. We just run our simulation a number of times, and then we take a sample average over all of those, over each different run, and then, so that sample, the M sample averages, or excuse me, n sample averages become your n samples, and your system estimate is the batch average of the sample averages, or the batch average of the run averages. Okay. So, and again, these runs are, or the averages from these runs are independent because you would use sort of a different starting point or a different seed to start off your system each time. One consideration in this method, again, is that you have to ensure you've reached steady state before you gather your statistics. Okay, so the last topic I will mention in terms of output analysis is that it's not always possible to have completely uncorrelated data, or data that's completely independent of each other. And in the case that we don't have complete independence, we may still be able to apply our techniques, but again, we will want to modify our variance to reflect the non-independence of the data. Okay. So, for any, so we can define a measure of non-independence called a correlation between any two random variables. And what we're going to do then is apply this measure of dependence or correlation to our sequence of observations, our sequence of observations, and then use that to modify the standard deviation appropriately. Okay, so our measure of non-independence is we start with the covariance, which is the expected value of x minus its average times y minus its average. Now, if those two are independent, you would expect this to be zero. They have nothing to do with each other. You can split out the two and the expected value of x minus mu x is going to be zero. Okay. Same y minus mu y. Okay. Now, if they're equal, what do you get? Well, you can substitute in x minus mu x there, and you'll see that you're going to get your variance term out. Okay. And so the covariance, again, ranges somewhere between no relation and total relation between the two variables. And then the covariance can range between plus and minus infinity. And usually covariance is normalized by dividing by the standard deviation of x and y. And this will give us a value then called our correlation, which is between plus and minus 1. So it gives you a measure of how related x and y is, just in terms of a single number. Okay. Again, if two variables are the same, then your covariance is going to be 1. And obviously, if they're independent, your correlation will be 1. If they're independent, your correlation is 0. Okay. So what we'd like to do is estimate this correlation for our sequence of observations. And again, the slides are out of order. Sorry. Okay, so we define our estimate in terms of, and this should also be correlation, our estimate of the correlation in terms of a sum. So in this case, we're taking pairs that are right next to each other, and we are calculating their correlation. In this case, we are calculating the covariance of the pairs, and then we're normalizing by the variance factor. Okay. So if we only examine pairs that are adjacent to each other, this is called a lag one autocorrelation. We can also estimate sort of pairs that are farther apart. Okay, so lag n is examining pairs that are, or lag k, I should say, is examining pairs that are a distance k apart. Okay. And what you would expect, again, is that the farther apart they are, the less correlation there's going to be. So typically, you don't, after a certain point in time, you aren't going to look at the lagged correlation anymore. Okay. And so what we can do with that then is we can come up with a somewhat modified estimator for our system variance. Okay. And use this modified estimator to compute the confidence interval. Again, this is not something I'm going to expect you to do. And what I would suggest is that you sort of, again, be aware of this. And potentially, it is of use to actually calculate these autocorrelations just to you make sure that your system is truly, or that your samples are actually independent. But I am not going to expect you to actually produce a modified estimate of your variance. Okay. So that's something, again, just to be aware of. In our case, we're going to sort of happily assume that our estimates are going to be independent. Again, if you use the technique of generating separate runs, this should not particularly be an issue. If you use the batch method, then it is a bit of an issue. Okay, so that wraps up the discussion of the analysis of output and brings us pretty much to the end of our time. I apologize for the typos. I will produce a corrected set of slides. Again, I think it's clear, sort of, if you're looking at the Camtasia, what the sequence should be anyway, but I'll produce a set of slides that's correct and in sequence. Okay, now I'm just going to say a brief bit about sort of the context. Paros has two pages on the validation of the simulation model. And I mentioned this again because it's another place where statistical analysis enters into simulation. And in particular, what we mean by the validation of a model is convincing ourselves that our model actually represents a real system. Okay. And typically one of the big parts of that is convincing ourselves that our representation of input is actually representative of the actual system input. Okay. And so what we need to do is check what we've modeled against both potentially observational data and also against the mathematical distributions. So we talked a bit about one aspect of input validity in terms of the random number generators, in terms of looking at the convince ourselves that the random number generator actually represented a uniform distribution. And yeah, similarly, you want to be careful that if you have a stochastic variant, that's actually being represented as well. And typically, you would use some sort of goodness of fit tests. And again, the one that's probably most common is the chi-square test. We mentioned it earlier. Obviously, there wasn't time today to get to it. Okay. So, if you're interested in looking at, again, the input and how the inputs, how you can match real-life input to mathematical models, then Banks has a very good chapter on that. It's readable and it sort of sets out the issues quite nicely. And, this is not in the scope of the course, but again, if you go on sort of with the simulation vein, then it might be of interest to you. Okay, so again, apologies for the ordering of the slides. I don't know what happened there. I will post a reordered version with the few typos corrected as well. Mm-hmm.